The News Dissector with Danny Schechter, Fridays at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Well, this is Danny Schechter, your News Dissector here on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. The number to call if you'd like to join our conversation is 888-874-4888. We have quite an interesting and exciting show for you today, so please stay with us. I'm sorry to have to interrupt the promos. I know you were looking forward to another 50 promos here on PRN, but we'll try to accommodate in the break with some more promos from more shows that you probably won't get to listen to. But it's okay. That's part of how we don't pay the bills here, because there are no bills to pay. Progressive Radio Network is a not-for-profit operation created by Gary Null, and I'm happy to be able to add my occasional 2 cents to the mix. So I'm pleased to be with you. There's a lot to talk about today and a lot in the news before we get to our guest. Occupy Wall Street. I've been covering this with a certain amount of religious devotion. My latest article appears on Al Jazeera English website. So in other words, I'm getting placement on a website in another part of the world that is read by people throughout the world, which is quite, you know, significant. Sometimes 200,000 people will read an article there. It's got a tremendous global reach. I'm happy to be part of it and invited to be on it. I also do my own blog at newsdissector.com every morning, offering some analysis of the news and what's not in the news, what's missing from the news. And that's why I'm called the News Dissector, because I'm also looking for omission as much as commission. And today, there's a lot of commission to be found. First, there's the commission of the reports on Occupy Wall Street, with Mayor Bloomberg being quoted, you know, to the effect that he must have to act, get tough, Mike, says the New York Post, do something about these people, say other right-wing media outlets. Fox News is ready to hang him up to dry if he doesn't do something, whatever it is. At the same time, he is allegedly a supporter of free speech, and of course, he is also quite objectively part of Wall Street. So, you know, he's got a bit of a number of issues there to sort out. Is he with the 1%? Is he with the 99%? As the folks there define the world, I think the answer to that is kind of obvious. The problem is that a lot of what the mayor is saying is factually not accurate, okay? And I point to some of those inaccuracies in my Al Jazeera article. And there's also a newspaper published at Occupied Wall Street Journal, they call it. And they have a whole takeout, an analysis of what the mayor is saying and why what he's saying either doesn't make sense or doesn't really reflect the reality there in the park, in Zuccotti Park. So that's an immediate issue to look at. Tomorrow here in New York, there's going to be a march apparently from Zuccotti Park at around 2:30 up to Foley Square to the courthouse up there to object to the Obama administration making a deal with the banks, i.e., we won't prosecute if you give us some money. That's the deal. In short, it's not a deal that the people who are part of this movement like at all, and they're going to be saying so tomorrow. On Monday, another protest, right? I'm doing the thing with my fingers, as is my guest, but you can't see me. And also another protest to take note of is on Monday, the New York Historical Society, in all of its wisdom, is honoring a great history maker here in New York by the name of Henry Kissinger. And this little honor to Mr. Kissinger, Henry the K, doesn't sit well with a lot of other historians, much less a lot of other people. It's going to be happening up at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel, big fundraiser for the Historical Society.
Longest living war criminal award?
Yeah, I'll get to you in a second, Randy, but it's a war criminal protest against Henry Kissinger. It starts at 5:45 on Monday at the Waldorf Astoria, an appropriate location and genre venue for events like this. The last time I was up there covering a protest, I think, was when Rupert Murdoch was receiving a big award from the Zionist community for his devotion to Israel. And he called himself a Christian Zionist, and there were a lot of protests there at the time. It's not clear if the New York City Police Department will allow the protest to take place there. It may have to take place in the East River if the mayor has his way. So we'll see what happens on that front. The other front involving Israel is a very important issue. Apparently, all the Israeli papers are reporting that a strike by Israel on Iran may be imminent, which could lead to another war. That Israel has been doing exercises and perfecting this. The Netanyahu government wants to strike Iran, supposedly because Iran represents a, quote, existential threat to Israel. I don't know really what the Jean-Paul Sartre has to do with this, but nevertheless, that's the argument. And this has been getting attention all over the world. The New York Times covers it today on page A10. And they don't really report any new developments about it, but they look at the media coverage, which is a way to avoid dealing with the issues itself. They've downplayed it. It could be very serious. It could be a turning point if Israel does strike at Iran, because Iran also has missiles. And, you know, a lot of people can get hurt if this happens. This is not a cakewalk as Iraq was supposed to be. So now we've dealt with a few news headlines, hoping that you'll join us at 888-874-4888. And it's time now for our first guest. I'm sure Maestro at the board will hit the first song about now.
You know what it means to miss New Orleans and miss it each night and day. I know I'm not wrong, the feeling's getting stronger the longer I stay away. It's the moss-covered vines, the tall silver pines where mockingbirds used to sing. I'd like to see the lazy Mississippi a-hurrying in to spring. Oh, the Mardi Gras, the memories of Queen
Sachmo singing about the city that he loved so much, New Orleans. And in the studio with me is another New Orleans person, Randy Fertel. Randy is the author of a new book, The Gorilla Man and Empress of Steak, a New Orleans family memoir. Now, this is a book, folks, that you will find fascinating, as I did and as I do, because I'm still working through it. I'm savoring it as opposed to just quickly digesting it. But it's a very interesting and extremely ambitious examination of one of the great New Orleans families, Randy's mom, who created the Ruth Chris steak chain, which is all over America, who is a dynamo and the world, and who's a dynamo, and who at one point Randy, the dutiful son, actually sued in court. And we're going to hear about that. And, you know, this is a story that takes place against the background of one of America's most unique cities, a city that was devastated by Katrina in what Randy refers to as the federal flood, not a term that people outside of New Orleans use very much. It's essentially blaming federal government agencies for the catastrophe that happened there.
We get all bent out of shape when people speak of it as a natural disaster, because the winds that hit New Orleans in Katrina were weaker than the winds that hit it in Betsy in 65. It was entirely a function of the breaking of the levees, and the breaking of the levees was entirely a function of badly managed, badly built levees.
And also Mr. Goh, right? I mean,
Mr. Goh was a terrible, terrible Army Corps of Engineers mistake perpetrated in the 60s and the Mississippi Gulf outlet. And so we talk about the federal disaster.
So that's important to know.
Like reparations, but well, they've been slow in coming.
That's important to know, because the voices of New Orleans have been sort of flooded out along with their lives in many cases, and what actually happened to them and is still happening to them is not just a function of the insensitivity of the Bush administration. Alas, it seems to be a continuing saga.
Well, Obama made grand promises too and has not delivered on them. You know, that's I mean, my fantasy when you know, we were all excited about his election was that he would announce his WPA project in New Orleans. Let's save the most important city in America, the soul of America, by launching this WPA program that we are going to need to bring back our economy. Of course, all that went down the tubes.
Yeah, and that is the whole demand for jobs, which we're hearing about today. The Republicans, yesterday, voted down a proposal for federal spending on infrastructure projects. Essentially, there's no commitment to new jobs, at least not as created by the government. The so-called private sector is not creating jobs either. They're sitting on trillions of dollars that, you know, basically they've enriched themselves on by exporting jobs around the world, by outsourcing jobs to China and other places. And so we have a situation where, you know, even the Federal Reserve Bank is saying, you know, the indicators look bad, but we're not going to do anything about it. So we're in for, I think, folks, a lot more serious downturns in the weeks and months ahead. It's a story, just like the New Orleans story is a story that wasn't really fully told in most of the media. The story of Wall Street hasn't been fully told either. Story of crime, of fraud, of inattention by regulators, of insensitivity on the part of loan makers and lenders who lent money to people for homes that they knew those people couldn't afford, and on and on and on, with a lot of media complicity thrown in for good measure. And this is a subject that I deal with in my book, The Crime of Our Time, and my film, Plunder. But this is about another book today that we really want to get into. So, The Gorilla Man and the Empress of Steak. Decode this,
well,
if you will, Randy.
My mother was the Ruth of Ruth's Chris Steakhouse, and so she's the Empress of Steak, and she's, you know, justly famous for creating, you know, taking a little restaurant that was 17 tables and building it out to the largest upscale restaurant in the world.
And she mortgaged her home.
Mortgaged her home when my father was litigious and dragged her through the courts through an 8-year divorce just to impoverish her and her children, or his children. And she was dogged and working at Tulane Laboratory as a chemist. And so came the day that the settlement was done, and she was a gambler, and she looked in the classified ads, found a 3-line ad, steakhouse for sale, owner retiring, apply, 1100 North Broad. And so she went to her banker and said, you know, it's $18,000, what do you think? And he looked at the deal, and he says, well, Ruth, you know, you're going to need some inventory. Maybe you should borrow $22,000. Maybe she wasn't really ready for prime time, but she bought a prime steakhouse. And with that extra money, she made a go of it. She was a really hard worker, and people felt she was very charismatic. And next thing you know, it's a going success, and she's turning away people. So she hates the idea of turning away people, so she starts building other restaurants. And then people say, Ruth, you know, I drive down from Baton Rouge, and I'm going to kill myself drunk on the highway if you don't let me open my own up in Baton Rouge. So
a franchise system gets put in
place. The franchise starts, and I think she was pretty much on the cutting edge of a upscale franchise franchising. And so, you know, by the time we sold it in 99, there were 85 or 90 restaurants, and by the time she died, there were over 100, and now there are over 135. So it's the largest upscale restaurant in the world. Meanwhile, my father was as infamous as she was famous, because he ran for mayor on the platform that the zoo needed a gorilla. The sole plank in his platform was that he would go off to the Belgian Congo on safari and get 2 gorillas to give them to the zoo. And he campaigned in safari outfit, pith helmet, sometimes in gorilla costume. And his slogan was, "Don't vote for a monkey, elect Fertel and get a gorilla."
And
people were very charmed. And he took his 310 votes. They were charmed because they thought he was sending up the circus of our political system down in Louisiana, which is quite dramatically
Bizarro.
Bizarro. So he took his 310 votes as a mandate to go out and buy two gorillas, and somehow he found two gorillas and traipsed across the globe to Singapore and brought him back and gave him to the zoo and announced he was the only mayoral candidate in history who had kept all his mayoral promises even though he'd lost. And do you know that I found this out after finishing the book, so it's not in the book, but he became one of those perennial candidates, and his next run for mayor, he got 4,000 votes. So that's like a factor of over 10.
So, what did he promise then? Do you remember?
I think it was, I get the different campaigns mixed up. There was one where he rented one of those sound trucks, and he would ride around New Orleans saying, "And what about water? What, it doesn't make any sense. We're paying for water. There's water all around us. If I'm elected."
Yeah.
So, you know, he was a man of ideas.
And
what can I say?
And yet both of them were, you know, as it proved to be, not a great combination. And, you know, there was a bitter divorce, and there was also a lot of problems with the kids. And, you know, this is a story that you tell in a very personal and brave way. It's very rare for people to write about their conflicts with their parents quite so openly, and yet still really quite love their parents and quite treasure them. I think that's something that I think is very important. You would think, and you know, when I got this book, I thought, oh, it's a family history, a salute to the great ones of the family. And in fact, it's much more than that. It's really an examination of you growing up in another time, in a way, you know, a time of war, a time of change, and, you know, being caught in these cross currents with your parents who were really dated from another period in a way, and it was the generational, you know, uprising that I was sort of part of too, and I could really identify with it. But, you know, few people write about this in the way that you have, in a very personal and very meaningful way, in a funny way also. I mean, you have a lot of irony.
Well, there's a lot of colorful, you know, I mean, Dad gives me a lot of material. Like, we would go traveling together, you know, and he was a nutty traveler. Like, he insisted that he carry a golf club with him because he didn't want to lose his swing. So imagine trying to get your golf club through TSA.
So, you know, in writing about this story, you also write about the story of New Orleans.
Well,
as a city that you grew up with and grew up in and are still in a way part of, even if you don't live there all the time.
New Orleans is a city in love with itself. And I think for me, the process of writing this book, I came to understand better why it's so worthy of love, you know, why it's so, what makes it so unique, and why it's just such a treasure. So one of the special, you know, obvious aspects of that, you started with Louis Armstrong, and, you know, of course, jazz started there, and in fact, it started on my great-grandparents' front stoop, because they were on South Rampart Street, and they had pawn shops, and Louis Armstrong used to come in to hawk his cornet when he got into crap games and was losing. But even that's just a family story that without documentation, but there is documentation for the fact that my great aunt Nettie's, my grandmother's sister's husband's father, so her,
there'll be a quiz later, folks, so try to remember all this. Yeah,
his name was Jake Fink, and he sold Louis Armstrong his first cornet.
There you go.
So I have a little card that says Cornets to the King.
There you go.
Three generations.
But one of the things you talk about is this kind of conflict within New Orleans between the dark side and the bright side. In other words, it's a big convention city. It always has been. I was there actually documenting the making of Oliver Stone's movie JFK, which went into some of the characters in New Orleans that he believed were part of the conspiracy to kill John F. Kennedy.
That's all bullshit.
Well, So it may be, but nevertheless, many believed it. And also, we did probably the last interview with Mr. Garrison, who was the district attorney in New Orleans, who was, you know, fighting for a reopening of the investigation of the Kennedy assassination, maybe for his own reasons. I'm not sure why, but it seemed like this a tremendous story there beneath the surface of New Orleans, that New Orleans embodied all these currents of race and sex and corruption.
Power and money.
Power, yeah.
Well, you know, it's a complicated story, but, one angle to go in is Mardi Gras. Mardi Gras, is the roots are utterly racist. It was the white supremacist organizations that started Mardi Gras, and they did it in part because they were the French and Spanish colonial aristocracy looked down on these Americans who had come in after 1803, and they built their mansions in the Garden District to thumb their nose at the smaller mansions in the French Quarter, but that wasn't enough, so they decided they would co-opt this Catholic, they were Protestants, they would co-opt this Catholic Mardi Gras, which, you know, historically is a time when power is turned upside down. It's like Occupy Wall Street. You know, the fool is the king and the king is the fool. In New Orleans, that's not the way it works. It's all about celebrating power. And, people on the street begging for beads. And so the Mardi Gras is the only place in the world in New Orleans where Mardi Gras is a way of reconstituting power every year. I'm very proud that the Fertel family once threw one of the Mardi Gras crews out of their building. My great-great-grandfather Sam liked to play pinochle, so he negotiated a lease where he would get a membership, and he showed up to enjoy his membership, and they said, well, yeah, you're a member, but you're Jewish. You can't come in. So he the next time the lease came up, he threw him out. So I'm very proud of that.
You know, actually, I had a little bit of a history here, Randy. I noticed that your mom came from Plaquemines Parish.
Yeah.
And I was in the civil rights movement, and there were so many people in the civil rights movement from New Orleans who were particularly three come to mind. Rudy Lombard, who later became a chef and politician in New Orleans, Ike Reynolds and Jerome Smith.
Uh-huh.
And Jerome Smith actually had a big battle with Bobby Kennedy,
importantly,
and criticized the lack of enforcement of civil rights laws by the Kennedys. But they were also they introduced me to the whole world of the Zulu kings and the Indians of New Orleans, which kind of is part of the costuming there, which is so fascinating and rich in all kinds of textures. I mean,
of course, I did Tootie's Last Suit, you remember.
That's right, which is a play that
Mardi Gras Indian movie.
That Randy was part of. Now, there's another thing you've been involved in, Randy, in addition to your love of New Orleans and your conflicts with your family. You've been also a student and scholar and writer about the Vietnam War. And also the patron of an awards program named after the person who actually exposed the My Lai massacre. Can you tell us a little about that?
Well, Ron was a friend of mine
in
New Orleans.
Ron
Ridenour.
Ridenour.
Was an investigative reporter in New Orleans. He blew the whistle on My Lai, and then he became a George Polk investigative reporter. A George Polk Award-winning investigative reporter. And you knew him, right? You knew Ron.
I did indeed, and I also was an award-winning George Polk producer.
That's TV, a very significant award. And so Ron died way too young, 58, and I got together with the Nation Institute, and we do these annual awards in Ron's name to celebrate courageous truth-telling. So we've had an amazing run, amazing award winners, and you can go to ridenour.org and see the amazing run of winners we've had. I mean, Jimmy Carter and for his Palestine book, and Moyers, and
you haven't avoided controversy, and you've embraced
Joe Wilson was our first winner, Cy Hirsch, Dan Ellsberg, the whistleblower of all time. So it's been amazing.
And you also did a conference in New Orleans some years back on the Vietnam War that was
on
really...
the 25th anniversary of the My Lai.
Which was a very seminal event. So you've been engaged in all of these issues. So you're not just a steak man. You're not just a gorilla man. You're also a person that's engaged with the issues of our times. And I have to really say, I have to congratulate you for this book, because it's clearly a work of love. On the one hand, it's written with a tremendous amount of insight and feeling and sentiment for a time that's gone, that's in past, and yet at the same time it raises issues that are totally timely today. So I didn't get to be one of the many reviewers of the book, but I'm doing it here.
I appreciate
on the
everything
air,
you say. Thank you, Dan.
Because I really respect you. I should disclose, you know, when I was making my film WMD, which is an investigative film about the way the media promoted the Iraq War, didn't just cover it, but promoted it. Randy was one of the people who supported it and also did a screening for me in his home. So I have a great deal of respect for that and appreciation of your work. And I think that this book, The Gorilla Man and the Empress of Steak, is something that you will get a lot of attention for, and you deserve it. It's published by the University of Mississippi, no less.
Can I mention the GorillaManOfNewOrleans.com website has, rather than me blogging, I'm doing interviews, so people who have overlap with the book in any way. So Ham Fish has just done one of the Nation Institute. And
check it out, people.
It's really good stuff.
Check it out. Okay, thank you so much, Randy, for coming in. He came here directly from the hospital where some unknown affliction had to be dealt with. I just want to go out now before our break and the next 500 promos with a song from a CD that I picked up at Occupy Wall Street. It's called Corporate America by WRUW. I don't know who it is. I haven't even heard it, but I'll share it with you right now. Go.
Corporate America, time to undress. You're the reason the country is stuck in a mess. Pay our politicians to relieve your stress. From this day on, y'all better wear a vest. Me, I represent the political streets. With corporate America, we got beef. I've seen the dirt you've done like a common thief. Stealing from the people, trying to make ends meet. Cooperate, America, tell me what you think. I feel like Ken Lay should be in the claim. Oh, yeah, by the way, we ain't forgot about stealing. Some of them good old pipeline boys are gonna kill him. How y'all figure you're gonna ride out the gold? My taxpaying citizens' homes got sold. Their futures got shattered and plans got changed. Your people in power have gone insane. You filled up your britches with citizens' riches. You're just like Saddam. You'll end up in ditches. And if I ever see you, Ken, don't try to run. I won't use my gun. I'll beat your town for fun. I'm throwing blows.